Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the L.A. Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And I'm Leo. And tonight is our special guest is
Noelle Mead Izzy. And she's written a book called The Hummingbird That Answered My Heart's Calling. And is a testament to the power of nature and its ability to teach and heal and reconnect humans to their true human nature. It's a wonderful book. I found it so moving and so very, very special. And I look forward to interviewing Noelle. I thought you said 8:50.
8:30? Yes.
Okay. In about a half hour. So we're looking forward to having her. And after we talk to her, I know you'll be excited to get her book. I mean, it's just a wonderful book.
It's called The Hummingbird.
Mm-hmm.
And it's The Hummingbird That Answered My Heart's Calling, which is really, really a unique...
That's the title of her book, The Hummingbird That Answered My Heart's Calling.
Yeah.
That's the title.
Right. And... Okay, we're back.
I'm sorry that happened, that the phone got hung up. That was a mistake.
Yeah.
But she'll be on in about a half an hour. In the meantime, we have some news.
Yes, we do. And I was just going to ask you, could you talk about the book? Thank you. Anyway... some interesting things are happening. I don't know if you're following anything from anything about Israel. We've been kind of quiet on that subject, but we got some news for you on that coming up in a little while. But I wanted to start with a quote from Carl Sagan. And everybody remember him? I don't know. You probably have to be at least.
I think most
40 or 50 to
he's
who he
very
is.
Well known.
Well, yeah, but he's been dead for over 10 or more years. So.
But his thoughts aren't dead.
No, and he was the one that coined billions and billions of stars and stuff. But he said one of the saddest lessons of history is, if we've been bamboozled long enough, we tend to reject any evidence of the bamboozle. We're no longer interested in finding out the truth. The bamboozle has captured us. It's simply too painful to acknowledge, even to ourselves, that we've been taken. And once you give a charlatan power over you, you almost never get it back.
And that's a good definition of government.
Oh, that's a good definition of Obama.
Yeah.
Right?
Uh-huh.
You know, probably one of the greatest charlatans we've had.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And
and another one that resurrected himself is Bill Clinton.
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah. George Bush. I mean, they've been charlatans since for the last couple hundred years, I guess.
Really sad.
Yeah. But anyway, here's a little note. This is kind of an interesting note for us to... We've been an anti-fluoride advocates for a long, long time. But it's an interesting article that came up. It says that 97% of Europe doesn't put hydrofluorosilic acid in their water. Why do we?
For over 60 years, governments have been adding fluoride to drinking water supplies all over the world. Since then, we've seen a dramatic reduction over time as communities all over the world have come together to stop water fluoridation within their communities. Examples in Europe include Austria, Belgium, Denmark, Finland, France, Germany, Greece, Iceland, 90% of the UK, Spain, Scotland, Norway, Switzerland, and many more. It's become more obvious every day that industrial byproducts do not belong in our water. Just to be clear, we're not talking about the natural element of fluoride here. Over 90% of Europe doesn't fluoridate their water. It's not just Europe. Other countries like Japan and communities within Australia and Canada have followed suit as well. It was thought that a small amounts of natural fluoride in drinking water would help with tooth formation, but these claims are always referring to the naturally occurring fluoride, never industrial toxic waste. Despite being dubbed one of the top 10 public health achievements of the 20th century and praised by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, it's clear that we've been subject to manipulation of truth yet again. The United States has more people drinking fluoridated water than the rest of the world combined. Most industrialized nations do not fluoridate their water. Water fluoridation started many years ago when asbestos, PCBs, and DDTs were all deemed safe. These chemicals have been banned since. When the people woke up, it seems that water fluoridation will follow the same route. Opposition to water fluoridation has existed since its inception. In point of fact, fluoride causes more human cancer deaths than any other chemical. When you have the power, you don't have to tell the truth. That's the rule that's been working in this world for generations. There are a great many people who don't tell the truth when they are in power in administrative positions. Fluoride amounts to public murder on a grand scale, and some of the most conclusive scientific and biological evidence that I have come across in my 50 years in the field of cancer research. Dr. Dean Burke, biochemist, founder of Biotin, and former chief chemist at the National Cancer Institute of Health.
And what exactly are we drinking? So what exactly are we drinking? The substance added to our water, drinking water, is called hydrofluorosilicic acid.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it is a toxic waste substance created from the creation process of aluminum, fertilizer, steel, and nuclear industries. It's not the natural element of fluoride, again, it's industrial toxic waste. For example, in the phosphate mining and production industry, much of the hydrofluorosilicic acid occurs from strip mined rock. The rock is broken up, placed in giant vats where sulfuric acid is also added to get rid of whatever phosphate that the other contaminants are in the rock. While the phosphate is extracted, the contaminants used to be released into the atmosphere. This was creating more pollution and killing animals and plant life. Environmental regulations were put in place where pollution control devices were set up in order to capture the contaminants like arsenic, lead, mercury, silicofluoride, and more. While included in the pollution control device is hydrofluorosilicic acid, so toxic that no one needs to wear a full body that one needs to wear a full body suit and mask to be around it. These contaminants are then taken out of the chimneys, scrubbed off with this acid, and stored in open air cooling lakes, which are further exposed to airborne contaminants. In regard to the use of fluorosilicic acid as a source of fluoride or fluoridation, this agency regards such use as an ideal environmental solution to long-standing problems. By recovering byproduct fluorosilicic acid from fertilizer manufacturing, water and air pollution are minimized. Well, Rebecca Hammer, former director, deputy assistant for water, U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, says industrial practices produce millions and millions of gallons of this liquid hazardous waste. Because it costs these corporations thousands and thousands of dollars per ton to neutralize and dispose of hydrosilicic acid, they instead sell it to the population as a product. How ridiculous is that? Hydrofluorosilicic acid is shipped to your local drinking water suppliers.
If this stuff gets out in the air, it's a pollutant. If it gets into a river, it's a pollutant. If it gets into a lake, it's a pollutant. But if it goes right straight into your drinking system, it's not a pollutant. That's amazing. Former VP and senior chemist at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency headquarters. And here is a five-minute video by Abby Martin from RT News breaking it down for us. So let's put that on.
Please read the article. What's that? Okay.
Let's put that on.
Okay.
It's going to break
about 5 minutes, yeah.
Yeah.
Brainwash update. Well, that's good.
When was the last time you stopped to think about the one thing you can't live without? No, I'm not talking about the internet. I'm talking about water. Without clean drinking water, life couldn't go on. So it's probably important that we know what's in the water we drink. The past 65 years, city governments nationwide have been adding a substance called fluoride to the water supply. The practice of water fluoridation started at a time in history when asbestos, PCBs, and DDT were all deemed safe and effective. And although all of these chemicals have been banned since, fluoridation is still a common practice. However, it's uniquely American. The U.S. has more people drinking fluoridated water than the rest of the world combined. In fact, most industrialized nations do not fluoridate their water, including Japan and 97% of Europe. So what exactly is it that we're ingesting? Well, it's not the same fluoride that's in your toothpaste. What's being added to municipal water supplies is a fluorine compound called hydrofluorosilicic acid, and it's a byproduct from the phosphate fertilizer industry. Yes, you heard me right. Let me break this down for you. Gaseous fluoride is produced during fertilizer production. Now, it used to go straight to the atmosphere from these factories.
Mm-hmm.
But presently, filtration devices are used to contain the toxic chemicals. And what's extracted from the filters is then condensed into a water-based solution, which is packaged unrefined and sold to city governments for the purpose of water fluoridation. So how did this all start? Well, interestingly, in 1944, the American Dental Association themselves published that it was not worth the health risk to fluoridate water supplies. Too bad no one heeded their warning, because the very next year, Grand Rapids, Michigan became the first community to fluoridate. And what happened next would not have been possible without a push from the aluminum industry, which was looking for a way to safely discard their fluoride pollution and waste. In 1947, Oscar Ewing, a paid attorney for Alcoa, the biggest aluminum company in the U.S., was picked to oversee the Public Health Service, which is now known as the Department of Health and Human Services. He then made clear his lingering ties to the aluminum industry by promoting water fluoridation as one of the first official policies of the department. From there,
the policy expanded tenfold, with an additional 87 U.S. cities fluoridating within the next 3 years. Fast forward to today, where children are growing up indoctrinated with the notion that fluoridated water is necessary because it prevents tooth decay. But is that really the case? In 1987, the National Institute of Dental Research examined 39,000 school children from 84 different fluoridated and non-fluoridated communities. And while the study did find that in fluoridated areas, tooth decay declined, the most interesting part is that there was a declining trend in tooth decay in non-fluoridated areas, too, perhaps because of overall better hygiene. Okay, but not only is there no causal link, there's also serious health risks for fluoride overexposure. For one, an excess of fluoride causes fluorosis, which is the eating away of the enamel on your teeth. This is indicative of what it's doing to your body on a larger scale. You see, it doesn't just eat away at the tooth enamel. Only 50% of the fluoride we consume is excreted. The rest is absorbed throughout our bodies, our pineal glands, and our bones. In fact, an alarming study by the U.S. Public Health Service, which was later confirmed by Harvard Medical School, found that a deadly type of bone cancer called osteosarcoma was significantly higher in fluoridated communities than in non-fluoridated communities. However, the most distressing findings come from 18 studies done worldwide showing a substantial lowering of IQ in overly fluoridated areas. And there are many more adverse effects than just those, not to mention that the FDA admits that fluoride is a drug, not a nutrient. Multiple ethical codes are being violated here by forcing us to ingest this drug. Look, let's call it like it is. Water fluoridation has nothing to do with said benefits. Think about it. We're already getting our fair share of this substance through the dentists and the toothpaste we use every day. And what about the processed foods we're already eating and drinking on a daily basis? We get more than enough. So the argument that we need to ingest this substance as well is baseless. Look, guys, no matter what you think about fluoride, the real issue here is having a choice. No chemical, no matter what its alleged benefits are, should be forced upon the public without their consent. But let's not forget, as long as corporations are involved, our best interest isn't really the priority. So maybe we should be looking at water fluoridation as a money-making scam. It's a tale that's all too familiar. Governments and industry colluding to save money instead of saving lives.
That's for sure, huh?
Yeah. Well, we've known this for quite a while, and Lila and I have kind of been able to ban fluorides from our toothpaste and drinking water, where we have bottled water. But
you still bathe in it, and that's not healthy.
You can't help with that, to do that, but, you know, it's still, and it gets absorbed through the skin. But, you know, at least you're not drinking it, you know what I mean?
That's right.
And you're not...
But what a scam.
And what we're doing, I mean, we're killing ourselves, our entire population.
Well, they want a dumb population so that they can control
people. Well, not to dumb us down. Oh, you know what Prozac is? Fluoride.
It's fluoride, that's
it's
right.
Fluoride. Good Lord. And they're just, you know, unbelievably stupid. Anyway,
that's a big scam.
Yeah. Prozac. Yeah. Yeah. No. I don't know. We just get so bogged down in this. Lila and I. You just become so screwed. That's wrong. Don't you just love it when things go wrong?
There it is.
They didn't like our show. Okay, hang on a second. Okay, there we go.
What else do you have there?
I thought this was interesting. We don't get a chance to talk to them. We only get about 10 minutes. But I wanted to mention Luxembourg pension fund dumps nine Israeli firms over settlements.
Hmm.
Now that's a remarkable thing.
They made a statement.
They made a major statement.
Sort of like sort of like what was done to South Africa.
Exactly.
They boycotted them financially.
Yeah. And it said Luxembourg is a major banking, you know, it's one of the major
financial
centers. Yeah.
Luxembourg State Pension Fund FTC has excluded 9 major Israeli banks and firms and 1 U.S. company because of their involvement in Israeli settlements and human rights violation in the occupied Palestinian territories. The move follows similar steps taken by other financial institutions, including the Dutch pensions giant PGGM and Norway State Pension Fund. FTC is required to abide by a socially responsible investment strategy and has published a list of 61 excluded firms that do not comply with its standards.
These include all 5 of Israel's major banks, Bank Leumi, Bank Hapoalim, First International Bank of Israel, Israel Discount Bank, and Mizrahi Tefahot Bank, on the grounds of association to supporting construction of illegal settlements in occupied territories.
Other firms involved in settlement construction on the exclusion list are AFI, Africa Israel Investments, Jerusalem Economy Limited, and Real Estate Management and Development. The arms manufacturer Elbit Systems is excluded for its role in providing security systems for a legal separation barrier on occupied territories. Luxembourg, a member of the European Union, bordered by Belgium, France, and Germany, has a population of 500,000 people. As of 2012, the FTC pension fund held assets of almost 13 billion euros. That's $18 billion. U.S. firm barred for the Palestinian role. The U.S. firm, Motorola Solutions, is specifically barred from inclusion in the pension fund because of its association to assisting in human rights violations in the occupied Palestinian territory.
Now, it's interesting that Google has just bought Motorola. It's buying it.
According to Who Profits, Motorola Solutions has provided, through its Israel subsidy, equipment to Israel settlements and occupation forces. Dozens of other U.S. and international firms like arms maker Boeing and Lockheed Martin are on the list for various abuses around the world. Turkey's AK Bank is listed for its role in hydroelectric dam projects, breaching World Bank environmental and social standards. The Internet firm of Yahoo Incorporated is excluded for association to the violation of the freedom of expression in China.
U.S. firm L-3 Communications is barred specifically for its role in human rights abuses in Iraq and Croatia and for its role in marketing cluster munitions in the United States. According to Who Profits, the firm is also involved in making equipment Israel uses to enforce the siege and closure of Gaza. However, this is not specifically cited to the Luxembourg Pension Fund's document. Motorola appears, therefore, to be the only non-Israeli firm excluded specifically for a role in Israeli abuses.
The news of the FTC's banning of Israeli firms came as Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel, visiting occupied Jerusalem, announced her country's opposition to boycotts designed to hold Israel accountable for its illegal colonization. So she got mad at what was done. Too bad, Angela Merkel.
Well, she says, announced her country's opposition to boycott.
Yeah, they're boycotting it.
Yeah.
She's opposed to what Luxembourg is doing. Sad. She's not supportive.
I know. I think that's especially since she's the grand financier of all of the EU right now.
Yeah.
You know, so it's kind of like a,
visiting Israel.
But see, they can't be, the one thing that Germany can't be, uh-huh. is anti-Jew, mm-hmm. anti-Zionist, because of what they did in
World War II.
You can't do that. So,
yeah, but it's okay to support a country that persecutes others.
They don't care about that. Yeah, as long as it's not Jews. You know, like, oh, my God. But anyway.
So it's okay to support a country that destroys the Palestinian people.
Crazy. Isn't it? Oh, it seems like CNN.
Oh, Piers Morgan is getting the axe.
Yeah, finally. That's good.
It's lousy.
Yeah, that's good. Former Murdoch guy. Let's see. There's a couple of things, too, I wanted to go, but this is good.
Whoops, Dick Cheney unintentionally trashes troops in attempt to hit Obama.
Yeah. Yeah, he knocks the fact that, it's really amazing. Really amazing to me how this guy can still be, walking around. Former Vice President Dick Cheney took to Fox News on Monday night to lambast the Obama administration's proposed cut to the military budget, lamenting the president's desire to ensure that Americans have access to Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, SNAP, otherwise known as food stamps, despite the fact that over 900,000 veterans currently depend on them.
Uh-huh.
Imagine that. Cheney appeared on Sean Hannity's primetime show last night to discuss the financial year 2015 military budget as previewed on Monday's afternoon. Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff General Martin Dempsey announced, among other initiatives, a reduction in the size of the Army, a fact that didn't sit well with Cheney. While the hand-wringing that the Army will be smaller than at any point after World War II is mostly hype, the former vice president still readily agreed with Hannity's premise that the proposed cuts are dangerous, lamenting that Obama has not had Reagan-like increases in defense spending. I've obviously not been a strong supporter of Obama, but this really is over the top, Cheney says. It does enormous long-term damage to our military. They act as though it's like highway spending, and you can't turn it off or off.
You can turn it on and off.
Cheney also remains worried that in announcing a rebalancing of U.S. strategy toward Asia and away from the Middle East, that was the focus of his time in office, is just a cover for Obama to slash the military budget further and display his dislike for the military further. But you know, the amazing thing is that this son of a bitch still, I'll bet you he's not divested of Halliburton stock.
Oh, I'm sure.
Which is the main no-bid contractor for all of military services,
mm-hmm.
all right, and overseas, in Iraq and Afghanistan and wherever they are. Halliburton is providing the food and housing and everything else for these I mean, it's totally dependent on the fewer people that are in the military, the less money he makes.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that freaking animal. I hate Dick Cheney. Always have.
And his whole family.
Yeah, always have, always will.
That's unbelievable.
We're going to talk about more of this, but the Sandy Hook game changer, solid new evidence of a cover-up.
Mm-hmm.
And, this is something interesting, and we're going to go to it more in the future. I have a tremendous number of good videos and audio pieces that prove there's a serious, serious cover-up on Sandy Hook. I'm going to go to a quick music break, and we're going to bring on our guest.
Thank you. Hello, this is Noelle.
Hi, Noelle.
Yes. Noelle?
Yes, hi, this is Leo.
Yeah,
hello, Leo. How are you?
Good, how are you? And,
good.
We've introduced you already, and we both are fascinated by your book.
Your book actually brought me to tears. I was so
touched.
It was just such a special thing that happened between you and that wonderful hummingbird and the hummingbird's baby. It was just very special. Thank you for doing that.
Oh, gosh, my pleasure. And, you know, it's funny because as I was writing and editing, you know, it was almost as if I was on the outside looking in, and it was her story that I was editing and rereading, and it never failed. Every time I went back to the book to look it over, to do, you know, the edits or anything, I would cry. And it was almost like I would be experiencing it again and again and again. And, you know, there were especially certain parts of the book that it would bring me back to that moment in time. And it would move me over and over again. So I always know when I pick up this book, if I decide, you know, I think I'll read it and just kind of get in touch with that inner hummingbird again, I always know that I'm going to cry. I do. It's like her story, and I was just the conduit to bring it forth.
It was a very special story about the birth of a baby hummingbird that was right outside your window. Is that correct? On a terrace or?
Yeah. It was on a pine tree branch that just happened to hang over my balcony railing. And so, you know, she was arm's distance, and, you know, I had a little glider on the balcony, and I would just sit there and I would take pictures, and I would journal, you know, in my spiral bound journal, just sort of what was taking place. And basically, the book, the genesis of the experience, I don't really want to say the genesis of the book, because I didn't plan on writing a book. And only after 2 years, after I had this experience with this bird, did the universe kind of nudge me to put it down in a cohesive format. But the genesis of the experience was during the market crash of 2008, and I was experiencing horrific panic attacks, and I thought I was dying for several months, you know. And I did go to see the doctor, and the good news was, is, you know, he told me panic attacks and anxiety attacks can't kill you. So
sure,
that was, you know, what's that?
They sure can scare you and feel like they can kill you.
Oh my gosh, I thought I was going into cardiac arrest. You know, and then you can feel them coming on, and you're like, oh, God, here it comes. It's awful. And so I pretty much did my version of prayer, and that was just going out for walks and just breathing in and looking around at nature and just asking for any kind of divine intervention that can help me through this time in my life. And that's why the book is called The Hummingbird That Answered My Heart's Calling, because that is exactly what happened. I was calling for some kind of healing, whatever I needed. You know, I think it was an internal healing. There was so much imbalance in my life because of that time where everybody was just flailing because of this crash of, you know, the financial market as we knew it. And everybody was just in dire straits, and I was one of them. It just gripped me.
And it's amazing that a hummingbird answered your call. I mean, that's...
Well, you connected with it.
And you connected with it, and that she was there for you. I was really upset when you went to Paris, I have to tell you.
You want to know? I have to tell you, this is funny because I went there with a really close friend of mine, and we had a free flat in downtown Paris. for a week. So, you know, it was one of those things where we planned it way before this experience. And even though it was free, I, just like I said in the book, I would go out to that balcony and I would be like, I'm leaving. And I know that when I come back, your baby's going to hatch and I'm going to miss it all. And I was actually really torn, wondering if I should go. I was so engrossed with this experience. And my friend Christina was like, it's okay. You know, the baby won't hatch. The baby won't hatch. And I would bring, I brought pictures. Like on the way back from Paris, it was a one flight, 12-hour flight. And someone had a heart attack on the plane. And we had to land somewhere in Canada or, you know, up north in North America, so that we could get the person that had had the heart attack off the plane into, you know, some medical attention. And I remember sitting there, and we were on the ground for 4 hours outside of the regular 12-hour flight, and all I could think about was this bird. Get me home to my bird. Get me home to my bird.
Did you put together why the fascination was so, or why the connection was so
intense,
yeah. I mean, you wrote the book about it, I know, and, but I mean, what did you, I mean, I don't know, what was the reason for the obsession that you had with it? Part of it, or was it all real, or was it all just a really unique bonding that you had with this bird?
You know, it's so funny that you ask that, because I really, and I know in the book I mentioned anthropomorphizing her behavior, where there were times. Now, there were very tangible moments where I felt what was happening. When she flew back to the nest for the very first time, it's one of those things where the synchronicity or the nudge to be out there at the right time. And at the time, I was working from home. So I did have this opportunity, you know, during the day to go out and see what was going on. And for the most part, you know, she was going through the typical hummingbird motions, you know, where she would go out and forage for nectar and she'd bring it back and feed the baby. And then she'd sit on the nest for a while. So it wasn't anything out of the ordinary. But when the times came where I needed to capture something, by the grace of whatever was inspiring me, I would go out there at the right time and I would capture something that was so valuable in for me, where I would just be like, oh my gosh, this emptiness syndrome that human beings go through, I am literally experiencing that, watching where this axiom was actually came from, and that was the birds. And she flew back to the nest, and her nestling had fledged, and I saw where he went. I in my book I called him the little baby. I saw where he just bebopped across a couple branches, and he just kind of sat there like, wow, okay, here I am. I'm not in the nest anymore. These are big steps. I'm so proud of myself. But she flew back, and I just watched her. And it was one of those times where her beak was just caked in pollen. Like, you know, she was out there, and she was gathering those great meals for her baby, and she was going to come back and nourish him with it. And he was gone. And I remember her standing on the edge of the nest, looking into the nest, and just staring in there. And tears just down my face. And I was like, oh my gosh. And I could just feel like my heart was sort of breaking, but at the same time, I was so full of profound gratitude that I was experiencing this. I was watching just me and these two birds. They made me privy to their unfolding of what this beautiful creature goes through. And, you know, it was just moments whereby she took off and I could hear her typical clicking sound where she was sort of making herself known. There were these sounds that she would make depending on what was going on. And she'd kind of hover and click. And I looked over and the baby was, you know, looking up around like, you know, hey, I'm down here. And she flew right down, perched right next to him and started feeding him on the branch, and he never went back to the nest again.
That was a big step and, for him.
But then she,
oh, it was,
but she was still with him, kind of, in the book you stated, she was still with him, teaching him how to fly.
Oh, yeah, for I would say 2 weeks.
Yeah.
It was, yeah. But they never, she'd go and fly back to the nest and kind of just hang out there, but he was always on the little branches. They just, it was like that the home that she had built was no longer of use because he wasn't going backwards. He wasn't going to go back to the place where he, you know. So, yeah, it was 2 weeks of them just now partnering with one another, and he'd test his little wings out and fly to another branch, and then she'd go find him and feed him, and you know, then eventually I went outside and they were gone.
I wanted to compliment you on the photography because I thought that was very, very good.
Well, thank you.
Got some great pictures.
Beautiful pictures. They were moving along with your words. I thought it really,
yeah,
really was wonderful.
I have to admit, I don't think I've ever read a book like that before. Not quite as it's hard to explain that actually the
impact that
it had on me, and there's a question here that I'd like to pose you to you, and it's how did it change your life and your experience?
Oh my gosh!
Amazingly, huh? Yeah. I mean, even to this day, you know, since you wrote it and talking about it again and again and again, I'm sure it just, you know, brings back a lot of interesting insights. But how did it really...
did it change your life?
Did it change it, and in what ways?
Well, it's, you know, to this day, it I haven't stopped changing because of this experience. So immediately after it, well, first of all, the first thing that changed in my life during the time was I actually stopped experiencing panic and anxiety. And I believe that it was like this distraction, this beautiful distraction that took me away from my self-indulgence, or not self-indulgence, just self-centeredness. You know, we go about life and we don't stop. And it's very cliche, but this is what I learned. Everybody says, you know, don't let life pass you by without stopping to smell the roses. Well, let me tell you, we spend our days with everything around us that is so magnificent and as backdrops, like, oh, you know, we never stop to pay attention to the majesty around us of so much. So when I started to do that, when I started to divert my attention away from my self, prophesized woes, oh my gosh, you know, what if this and what if that, and, you know, the human being tends to be very self-centered. As soon as I got my attention off that and looked around me and appreciated, this is the smallest bird known to man. There's no other bird smaller than the hummingbird. The egg, the fact that the egg was literally the size of a Tic Tac, I couldn't believe that there was a life form, a life force that was growing in this teeny, tiny, tiny little egg. And I just started to become awe-inspired. I started living in childlike awe again, like I remember when I was a kid. So it changed me physically, whereby the panic attack stopped. So that was that. Then I started to see how when we align ourselves with nature, if we just take the time to appreciate it, it's almost like when Dorothy, what's that?
It has a healing quality. It really does.
Oh my gosh, absolutely. I mean, it's holistic just to be in it. I mean, even if you don't, you know, eat flower essences or whatever, but everything starts to have a glow. Like I was going to say, when Dorothy landed in Oz, The whole movie of The Wizard of Oz prior to her landing in Oz was black and white. And it was as soon as she landed there, the colors were vivid. Everything glowed. And that's what happened. I started to notice things that I would never have noticed before. And each moment of every day that I noticed those, it brought me to a place of really bona fide joy. I could feel at things that I would experience in out in the natural world where red-tailed hawks, I mean, I'd be on a walk and a red-tailed hawk would be circling over me and it would call out and I would look up and be like, whoa, and it would just circle and circle. And what's interesting is I started to study the symbolism of animals and animal totems and what they can teach human beings. And that started to become part of my photography and being able to say, well, here's the thing about red-tailed hawks. And I would get a photograph. It would just, these animals would show up and literally it was like they were raising their hand in classrooms and saying, can you pick me now? I'd like you to tell a little bit of my story. So the animal would show up. I'd take the photograph. I'd do my research on the totems and the symbolism. Red-tailed hawks aren't born with red tail feathers. They, over maturity, over time, those feathers become red, and it's a very spiritual thing that we go through. As we mature, we become that mature red-tailed hawk that has the vision, that has the wisdom, that can rise above the earth plane, the physical plane, like hawks do, and circle and see so much more than what we think we're seeing. We start to use our six senses. And the hummingbird, the symbolism of hummingbird, of all the animals out there that we come across that we just go, oh, that's a squirrel. Squirrels are so symbolic to our lives. They can teach us so much. If we stop and just enjoy their play and their work and their diligence to plan for, you know, the winter months, you look at that and they're teaching us something. So that changed everything that I came across, every animal. And my website has a lot of photography. Every animal has taught me something that I can then share with other people, that when you see those animals, even the tiniest animals, a lizard, lizard has great teachings. When you see those, don't just look at it and go, oh, it's a lizard. Look at it and say, oh, this creature showed up. This is between me and it now. What do I need to know? And it's, I know it sounds kind of la-la, but it can be such a beautiful distraction in life. It can be something that really enriches and fulfills us in ways we would never dream of.
Do you feel the same way about plants?
Oh, gosh. Absolutely. I
have a lot to teach us too.
See, Lila didn't say, but she's an avid, a very avid gardener, and especially flowers, plants. I'm a very avid photographer of her flowers.
Nice.
As well as nature, and on my website I have a lot of.
So we really appreciate what you have to say about animals.
Yeah, the connection is there, and it's so intense, really, that it's very hard to explain unless you are a photographer that you can really. I don't know. I call my work transdimensional especially in nature photography, because. It takes you to a totally different place, you know.
It's a very spiritual thing.
Yeah, and connects you to a spiritual level that most people don't appreciate. That's why I appreciated your photography, because it had such a personal touch to it. You know, it wasn't a commercial photo. You know what I mean? You could see your emotion in it. You could see your and your careful editing of that as well, and enhancement of the colors and contrast and so on. So I appreciated your work very much.
Reading your book was was an experience. I almost felt like I was right there with you.
And as a writer, you you know, I appreciate that connection that you were able to get with us.
Thank you.
How has the reception of your book been?
Yeah.
What kind of response have you gotten from people?
Just exactly. I mean, I can't tell you how much I love to hear people saying, I felt like I was right there experiencing this. I have had people tell me that. I'm, you know, the reception, the response is just what I had hoped. And it's just where people, like you said, I mean, I've had people say it made me laugh, you know, kind of made me giggle. And then I cried. And, oh, my goodness, you know, this is what made me cry, and that's what made me cry. And the way, you know, you were able to explain just the goodness of nature around us and how we can connect with that, and it can change our lives, you know. And so I don't think I've had anybody. I think there was one person I did get one review that the book reviewer said she would have liked to have seen more Christianity in it, because I used a lot of sort of New Age kind of language where I was talking more about the universe and kind of spirituality instead of religion and Christianity. But, you know,
yeah.
I was raised Catholic, and I embraced my upbringing, and I went to Catholic school, and I believe in Jesus Christ. I believe that he was one of the greatest masters that walked this planet, and I am grateful for his life here. I believe Buddha was one of the greatest masters. I believe, you know, some of our greatest teachers were just, you know, regular guys that had a great message, like Gandhi, like Martin Luther King Jr. You know, we look at, like, John Lennon. I mean, I'm not comparing Jesus Christ to John Lennon, but there are so many people that have incarnated into this planet that have had really uplifting messages and teachings for us human beings. And, you know, I just...
Yeah, I'm sorry. I wanted to just say... Well, you, at the very ending of your book, you quoted Ralph Waldo Emerson, who's been an inspiration to me for most of my adult life. And I've done a number of programs on his work and read most of his essays on my shows. You know, nature and books belong to the eyes that see them, is your last quote by him. But... yeah, what his greatest, I'm sure you've read him, but what his greatest thing was, his connection to the spiritual world, was nature, you know, and to himself. That connection was nature. And
and like you were saying, we often forget that. With the hustle and bustle of our lives, we walk by so much that's so important. And who's to say what's important and what's not? What the hummingbird spoke to you was probably as important as what any person, or more important than any person, could speak to you.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
learned from that, yeah. from the experience, from her experience
and
of
playing.
Artemis.
Yeah.
And why did you call her Artemis, by the way?
I was going through, I have like angel cards, and I was, I loved studying, like, the different goddesses of historic cultures, you know, like the Indian goddesses and the Greek goddesses and the Hindu goddesses. I loved that feminine, female energy, you know. And so before I met Artemis, I had these cards, and I would read up on them, and it was just, I liked learning about, you know, these women, you know, whether it was folklore or reality. It was just interesting. And I remember sitting on my bed, and the balcony that she was nesting on, I had a glass slider that led out from my my bedroom. That's why in the morning when I came back from Paris, it was a hot, you know, summer day, and I had the glass slider open, but I had the screen closed. And that's why I heard her at, you know, 5:30 in the morning, because she was buzzing right at my screen door looking into my bedroom.
Oh, she was calling you. But before tonight, I would like you to share with our audience where they could get your book.
You can get it on my website. My website is BEE, so it's like little honeybee, BEE-Benevolent.com. So my company is Benevolent, and so because I'm a supporter of all of our pollinators, my website is Benevolent.com, but there's a dash between B and Nevolent. So you can go online and order one there.
Okay.
Well, I appreciate your work. I wanted to mention more about it. We ran out of time, but on pollinators, on your work,
protecting them.
Well, awareness of making awareness of bees and bats and you know, and the endanger, the danger we have of losing them, or you know, hurting, you know. I read something recently that a possibility that within 20 years, the bee population may be completely devastated. I don't know if that's true or not. Have you heard that?
Oh, gosh, yes.
Yeah.
I've heard before 2035, if we don't stop what we are doing now to the environment and, you know, to... that's affecting the bees, which, you know, the scientists, since 2006, colony collapse disorder or vanishing bee syndrome has been claiming many of North America and Europe's bees. And so the studies were started in 2006. And at that time, scientists weren't exactly, they couldn't pinpoint what exactly the reason was whereby millions of bees, you know, 75 to 100% of hives in one season would leave the hive and never return, leaving the queen, all of the larvae and the drones to die, because the worker bees are the ones that bring back all the food and the pollen, and they build the hives. And so there was no definitive, but there is now science showing that the pesticides, the neonicotinoids that are being mass sprayed on all of our agriculture, are having a really detrimental effect on the bees. Now they're trying to figure out, is it physical where they just die, or does it mess with their ability to navigate themselves back to the hive? But we do know that this is destroying them. So we know that enough now.
Well,
I hope there's some work out to prevent that from happening.
Me too. And maybe that could be another show for us to talk about. But I want to thank you so much for being on. We had we enjoyed your book.
And thank you so much for writing such a touching account.
And I wish you a lot of success.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, and I really enjoyed being on your show. And you guys take care.
Okay. Good night.
Thank you very much.
All right. Good night.
Thank you, folks, for being with us, and I hope you're able to get her book. I loved it.
Her name was Noelle Mead Izzy, the name of the book is The Hummingbird that Answered My Heart's Calling. Okay, it was very fascinating. It's available on Amazon, but you can also get it on her website, which is benevolent.com.
Yep.
Right? And hope you do get that. And in the meantime, join us tomorrow night right here when we discuss union issues with our good friend Larry Dornan, public affairs coordinator for ASME Union. And we will be...
In the meantime, enjoy your evening and talk to you tomorrow night.
Yeah.
Good night, folks.